Yeah.
Good.
The House Committee to touch base with you about an OPAC thing I'm thinking of. So.
House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities will please come to order. Today we have an informational meeting on a couple different topics, cell phone being one of them. The Department of Forestry and Department of Agriculture are going to talk to us about the sudden oak death quarantine. This is a very serious issue, and appropriately the nursery industry in its entirety just walked in the door. I hope it's not wearing that Oregon Duck watch. Okay, thank you. Thank you.
It's going to be tough.
And we'll hear a lot more about it. But the thing that I was struck by during last session when we started to hear about the quarantine and then through the interim when we had to expand the quarantine area is the effects, particularly on nurseries, of what happens if you're actually in the quarantine area. Because then you're, if I remember right, you can't sell your product outside the quarantine area. That's a pretty small area to be selling your product in, and devastating. So we all need to have folks hear about that, understand what the implications are, because it's a program that has to have support from the state to be able to combat it, unlike our neighbors in California who decided to just let it go, which Representative Rowan.
I would like to say that I appreciate Representative Krieger keeping it all in his area.
Yeah. Okay. Before I have them up, I just want to let folks know that we have a response to Representative Roblin's question regarding the Elliott State Forest. It should be in your packets. You have it. I'm not going to read it into the record, but for you all, but I am going to place it in the record for last meeting. And you'll have it available to you. Okay. So we're going to have sudden oak death, some public testimony from a panel, and anybody else who wants to sign up on the sign-in sheet. Then ODF&W talk to us about their upcoming bills, because I have a feeling there's going to be questions. And the part about the big fee increases in hunting and fishing licenses is where I expect a lot of that to come from. So we need to start talking now, because I know no one's ready to vote on that at this point. So that's the second part of it, is to begin those conversations and hear from the agency about their public hearings and what they heard. Later we'll be hearing from hunters and fishers themselves on that topic, of course, but I want us to start thinking about it. We will get we have those bills sitting in front of us waiting to be heard. So with that, I'm going to step out for a few minutes, and my vice chair to my left here is going to run the meeting. We did the hazing of our freshman member on the floor already. We don't need to do it here as well.
Thank you.
But, if you want to.
We will protect her.
Thank you, Representative.
You bet. So let's get started with our folks from Department of Agriculture, Department of Forestry, to talk about the sudden oak death problem or quarantine area and solutions. I'm going to mention while they're coming up on OPB, April 22nd, they're going to have their silent invasion invasive species program again. I think they had one already, or somebody did, and it's quite phenomenal from what I've heard.
They won
a prize for it. That's right. And start again on April 22nd. I've got a flyer here if you're interested, but it's on televised OPB, April 22nd, 2008. The Silent Invasion Invasive Species Program. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Who's starting?
I'm going to kick it off. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture, filling in for Lisa Hansen today. I'm going to do my best to fill her shoes. And with me is Dan Hilburn from the Department of Agriculture, Jim Paul from the Department of Forestry, and Alan Kanowski from the Department of Forestry. I called him Dave this morning. I have no idea where that name came from. For committee members that were here a session ago, our goal this morning is to update you in terms of what is going on in the world of sudden oak death, and for folks that are new to this issue to kind of bring you up to speed in terms of what is going on. Sudden oak death, or SOD, is kind of the common name for a disease called Phytophthora morum. It was first identified in the U.S. In California. California noticed trees dying around 1995, and in 1999 said, this looks like something different than what we've seen before, and I think first at that point in time identified the cause of the disease as Phytophthora morum. We were the fortunate ones to catch the spores in Oregon and identified it in the south coast in Oregon in 2001. It's a new disease, and we have been learning as we have gone on in the last few years in terms of treatment of this disease and how best to handle it. And I, by no means, I think, do we know for sure what we're doing, but we're giving it our best shot. The federal government through USDA and Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, or APHIS, is also very aware of this issue and is working with us to try to figure out the best way to deal with the problem. The disease affects both forest products and nursery products, and certainly those products that are within the quarantine area have a more heightened restriction in terms of where they can market those products. But in addition, for the nursery industry in Oregon, we have faced market challenges because the disease has been identified in Oregon in the South Coast. But for any product that is a host product for Phytophthora morum, we have had challenges in terms of moving our product into the market, any product from Oregon. So we in the Department of Agriculture have worked very closely with the nursery industry and have established an inspection program to try to provide market assurance for our nursery products. Very critical for the agriculture industry, considering the fact that nursery is indeed our number one sector within the ag economy.
Katie, just to clarify on that, so there's a prohibition against, if you're actually in the quarantine area, selling outside, and then there's an informal problem where people hear Oregon's got sudden oak death, so Oregon period is an issue?
That is correct, Mr. Chair, and you will hear from an industry panel following this group, both forestry and nursery, and they can go into greater detail, but we have had states that have refused to accept Oregon products early on in this process. Working through the federal government, there was actually a national program, a federal program established to try to provide market assurance. I would say for the most part is working, but I'm sure the nursery folks can give you an update on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This particular disease is very similar to the blight that we have on our cedar. Is that correct? I mean, the transport, it's the same kind of organism. Is that true?
Yes. They're both caused by a species of Phytophthora. On Port Orford cedar, it's Phytophthora lateralis. They're very closely related genetically, but the main difference between the two is that the cedar disease is a soil-borne and waterborne pathogen. It affects the roots. And Phytophthora morum, the cause of sudden oak death, is an aerial pathogen, spreads in the air and infects foliage and above-ground parts.
And so, have everyone identify themselves now so that you don't have to keep doing it each time you talk to the first time. So why don't you...
My name's Alan Kanaski. I'm the forest pathologist for the Oregon Department of Forestry in Salem.
I'm Jim Paul, the chief of the Private Forest Division, which includes our forest health program in Salem.
I'm Dan Hilburn. I'm the administrator of the plant division for Oregon Department of Agriculture.
Could I do a follow-up on that one?
Sure, yes.
And so that's the because of transport and because of the particular variety of plant that it attacks, that's why that one has not caused a problem with the nursery stuff?
The Port Orford cedar disease? Yes, that's also an invasive species, but it's been here for so long and was so widely distributed that there was no quarantine on it. We missed the boat on that one.
Thank you. Please.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm going to move on to the technical experts, but the last thing I want to say is sudden oak death is an invasive disease, And I think all of us believe that as we continue to experience the effects of climate change, that things like this will provide a threat to Oregon's environment and natural resources base more and more in the future. The Silent Invaders program that the chair referenced is a very excellent program. It was shown on OPB last summer. Last spring, and then they're re-showing it. It's a very, very well-done program dealing with invasive species in general, and if you have time, it is well worth watching. With that, I'm going to pass the microphone over to Dan Hilburn to go into more detail.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here today, and I want to just pause for a minute and point out that this is an extraordinary discussion that we're having, because in most places around the world, you would never be discussing the possibility of eradicating a disease from a forest. It's never been done. And I want to give credit to the people sitting beside me for taking this on and really attacking sudden oak death in a way that hasn't been done before. It's an extraordinary effort in Curry County, and they've done wonderful things. This is a classic invasive species. It has the potential to do what chestnut blight did to our forests. It just completely changed the ecology of the forest by changing the species composition. It's another Dutch elm disease. We caught it very early in Oregon, and that's one of the key reasons we've been able to do what we have here. In 2001 in Brookings, the Forestry Department was looking for it. The Department of Agriculture had instituted a quarantine already, and they found it very, very early. It hadn't been there very long, and we know that because the trees still had brown leaves on them when we found them. In other words, they died the same year that we found them. So that's one of the reasons why we have a chance to do something different in Oregon that California didn't, and other places haven't had the chance. Another reason why this is special is that none of our individual agencies could have done this by themselves, but ODF and ODA worked with the U.S. Department of Forestry and Oregon State University and formed a team to attack this, and I think that's another reason why our response has been as successful as it has. Two other things. The South Coast Lumber and the landowners in the area have been especially helpful and supportive of the idea, and the industry, the nursery industry and the forestry industry, have also been on board with this from the beginning and helping out. So those things are all very important. We have a range of options today, and I'm glad you're looking into them. We could do nothing. We could let this disease go. We could mount an eradication program, and we potentially have the ability to get rid of it completely. That would be very expensive, but there's a range of things that are available to us, and that's really quite extraordinary. Potential impacts. I want to just spend a minute on that. The forest ecosystem in southwestern Oregon would change completely if we were to turn our back to this one. Tan oak is a very important component there. There's another species of oak which is also very susceptible to the disease called California black oak in the same area. The nursery industry, Katie's already talked about the market implications there. But a recent economic analysis of what this means to the nursery industry, and I gave you a handout which summarizes what the economists tell us is at stake in the nursery industry. $65 million to $652 million over 20 years in additional costs and lost markets. The forestry industry, it's even more, $151 million to $1.2 billion in lost markets and increased production costs over 20 years. The potential loss of markets for both nursery and forest products just for having the disease. It's like a VD or something. Once you've got it, nobody wants to do business with you. So it's
that's common, depending what you got.
And then lastly, I think it's important that these changes, if they happen to our forest, are irreversible. When you lose a species out of the species mix, you can't get it back. So I'm going to stop there, turn it over to the forestry folks to go into the details and tell you what the current situation is and the options for the future.
Vice Chair Van Orman, members of the committee, my name is Alan Kanaski with the Oregon Department of Forestry. When we first found sudden oak death in Curry County, it was a very small infestation. We had about five sites that we identified in the first aerial survey. And the first step after that was that the Department of Agriculture put a quarantine around that area. Subsequently, it's been revised and expanded about four times. The quarantine is designed to prevent human-assisted spread by limiting the movement of nursery products and forest products that could inadvertently carry the pathogen. At the same time, we got some funding from the Forest Service to start the eradication process. Now, the process of eradication is fairly simple. It's cutting and burning all of the host plants in the infested area, plus in a buffer around those plants to try and capture any kind of hidden infection. So for the first few years of the eradication, we were doing pretty well. We saw a decreasing number of infected trees and a decreasing number of infested acres, and we were fairly encouraged in what we were doing. We took all the credit as being due to our eradication effort, but in reality, the weather had something to do with that, I'm sure. The weather during those years was favorable for us and not for the pathogen. And then in 2005, the trend, and it's on one of the charts in your handout, the trend changed, and we started to see an increasing number of infected trees each year and an increasing number of new sites. This was driven largely by the weather, but it was also a factor contributing to that was we've had some delays in our process down there due to interruptions in funding. And a very important one was in the beginning of 2008. We had a five-month shutdown of the program, and during that period, which is a critical time for disease spread, we had more spread than we have seen in previous years. But on a positive note, 2008 was the first time in recent years that we saw a decrease in the number of infected trees. The only thing that's different about 2008 that's still of concern is that we did see more sites, but they were smaller sites, meaning that we caught them early. So in some respects, 2008 has been a fairly good year for us despite the high level of infection. If you look at one of the maps in your handout, the extent of the disease moving from south to north has also changed a little bit. In previous years, we always saw expansion to the north, and 2008 was the first year where we saw no expansion to the north. So that in itself is encouraging. What we like to say about the program is it's been a partial success so far. If you look at the sites that we've treated, we've gotten rid of the pathogen on at least half the sites. So the treatment can work, but it's still slowly spreading despite these efforts. And the only way we can compare whether we're having success or failure is to look at similar situations in California. And there was one situation in Humboldt County that started at about the same time as our Oregon infestation. It had one infested site. It was less than 2 acres. They've been unable to mount a control effort there. And in the same period of time, from 2001 to 2008, that site has increased to well over 4,000 acres. And if you add the total acres in Oregon that are infested, they add up to just a couple of hundred acres. The other factor about the expansion in California is that if you look at the extent of it, if our Oregon infestation would have expanded at that same rate, we would now have a full Curry County quarantine at least. And that's a very, very big benefit right there from doing our eradication effort, even though it's only slowing the spread. To date, just on eradication, we've spent $4 million. Half of that money came from the U.S. Forest Service Forest Health Protection Program. A third of the money came from the state, and the balance from BLM and APHIS. At the current level of activity, it costs about $1.7 million per year to do this program. And if we continue this effort, we'll have probably the same results that we've seen to date. The benefits of continuing the program are several. The first and most important in my mind are the ecological and economic benefits to both the forest industry and just to the forests of Southwest Oregon. The Tan Oak Forest is a very unique ecosystem. And if you look at the situation in California, it's fairly clear that without control, this pathogen would just spread through the Tan Oak system and I think destroy most, if not all, of the Tan Oak. The second benefit is lessons that we're learning from this process. There are a number of other eradication efforts in the U.S. on various insect and arthropod pathogens, but people are looking at Oregon now as a model for national plans for dealing with plant pathogens. And by no means do we have it figured out how to do this, but we have learned a lot in this process, and I think we continue to learn a lot, so continuing has some benefit beyond what we would see as an immediate benefit to Oregon. And lastly, and it's a side benefit, is that the eradication effort is jobs in Curry County. Most of the work done by contract crews, survey crews, are from crews in Curry counties.
We have a question from Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at this map of what's going on in Humboldt County, which you use as a comparison to show what happens when you don't do a program like you're doing. And on the back, I see where Humboldt County is located. I've actually been there. And I guess my question is no matter how much money we spend, if they're not controlling it down south, it's inevitably moving in our direction, it looks like. And all of the money, the millions of dollars that we would spend to address this problem, seems to me like it would be wasted if at the most it buys us a delay until this disease makes its way through Northern California and is apparently so large and so invasive that I can't imagine any program you could run that would stop it at the border. Can you help me understand that?
Sure. The situation in California, it's very different from Oregon. First of all, the power in the Department of Agriculture is at the county level there, as opposed to in Oregon where it's at the state level, and we have very good and strong regulations and cooperation. The disease has not made it to Del Norte County yet, which is our neighboring county. Between Redway and Del Norte County, there is a host-free zone being established. You can see it on the map, that little orange bar, where there's an area where the tan oak distribution necks down, and there's some agricultural land to the west. And there's a two-year project that's ongoing to remove all the hosts in a two-mile-wide swath. That's ideally to develop a barrier to spread of the pathogen northward. Coupled with that is Del Norte County has made commitments, and we have a letter of support from them that they will address the disease should it show up in Del Norte County. We have a very extensive monitoring system in place from Brookings through Del Norte County, looking at stream water, looking for spores in the streams, and we cooperate with Del Norte County on aerial surveys for early detection. So the combination of that early detection system, the host-free zone, and a commitment to treat sites that do show up in Del Norte in a fashion similar to Oregon gives us some assurance that I think something will happen in Northern California, and it will not just spread eventually to Oregon. It's interesting. They are equally concerned about getting it from us. Del Norte County is not under quarantine at this time, and we're only about 4 miles away with our nearest site. So they have the same comments towards us that they fear getting it from us. So I think there's a mutual understanding that something will happen in Del Norte County should it show up there. I don't feel like it's inevitable that it's going to spread from Humboldt through Del Norte County.
Follow up?
Yes.
So help me understand then what's happening here in Humboldt County. I mean, do you have any expectation that they have this under control? And if they don't and it continues to spread, again, I guess my question is are we talking about something that's inevitable you talk about boundaries, but we're talking about something that's airborne. And I can see from your own map that spots just kind of, in many ways, acts like a disease. You know, you have no idea really where it's going to show up. And I just wonder if they're not eradicating and dedicated to an eradication, a severe eradication program. There just seems to be some inevitability here.
There is. I still believe that it's not inevitable. A couple of reasons. We have an Oregon plan that we're working on now for how to deal with this. There's a national plan being developed for response to this outside of Oregon, and that would include Northern California. Even though there's not much happening in Humboldt County, there are still limits to how far this pathogen can spread naturally. We see a couple miles in terms of the maximum jumps that we see in most years. Every once in a while you get an outlier. And I think that the combination of a host-free zone and hotspot treatment, should it cross that zone, would be effective at stopping it. It's not a cloud of inevitability yet in Humboldt County.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Welcome. Madam Chair, I move that this committee direct the governor to sever all relationships with California immediately. And further, that Representative Krieger and Schaffler be sent on a chainsaw strike force.
We don't need a second motion.
The motion dies for lack of a second.
Madam Chair, you are prepared. I just want to follow up on the line of questioning, perhaps for you, Ms. Colbert, particularly that Representative Wingard started. Obviously, we're here talking about this one because it's not the most serious, a very serious issue here. Do we have others? What's the status of other similar kinds of diseases that we're either about to send to California or I suspect they're about to send up here? I mean, I just want to understand the pecking order of these kinds of threats.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, I cannot think of an example quite like sudden oak death where it's just Oregon and California dueling it out. However, we also joke in our office, and I've shared this with my counterpart in California, so I don't think it's like blasphemous to say it out loud, that California does a number of border patrol stations and those kinds of things, and we've wanted for a long time to have a border control station to prevent or inspect product coming from California into Oregon because of these issues. But as I said in my opening remarks, we are going to be dealing a lot more with invasives. California, just this last summer, took on a very extensive program to deal with light brown apple moth, as an example. We are very concerned about getting light brown apple moth in Oregon. And I can go example after example after example. You have hit on really what is the crux of the issue here is and the dialogue we've been having with our federal partners around sudden oak death. And if California isn't going to aggressively deal with it, what are the hopes of us actually eradicating it in Oregon? I think our federal partners don't have as much confidence as we do in our ability to eradicate it. But we dealt with gypsy moth in, 30 years ago in Lane County, and I don't believe people felt we could eradicate it, and we were successful in doing that. So we're fairly unique in Oregon in terms of how we have approached these kinds of issues in the past. But this is an ongoing debate. We realize there are very limited funds at the state level that we can put to this. We've been trying to put a lot of pressure on the feds to step up and bring more money in, give us a chance to really, based on what we've learned from the treatment so far, targeting spores in the water, these kinds of things, which the experts can go into much more detail. We want to give it a shot. And our federal partners are in ongoing discussions with us. I think there's a sentiment to try to do that. And you heard it earlier, certainly they want to use Oregon as a model for national programs of this sort. So that is indeed very good news. I think forestry can also speak to the fact that they have made a request for some of the federal stimulus dollars to be used for eradication in Curry County. It is on the ground work, it is job production, and whether we're successful at getting that or not, we don't know. But our focus right now in terms of resources really is on the federal government.
Quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Well, that's encouraging. I appreciate the answer. It seems to me that obviously the first order of business is what you're doing, is trying to deal with it. But leveraging this to make our point, I think, is really important, and I just want to encourage you that. I don't know what we're doing. Obviously, you're doing a lot department to department, but I don't know what our governor is doing governor to governor. And there's a new president. What's the guy?
I'm still in shock from the last one. I can't remember.
But with the new administration, it just slips my mind right now. It's a painful memory. And with We sent a guy from this house back there, so we have new members of the delegation in place. Let us know what we can do to help highlight that, because I think it's going to take more than Ag Department talking to Ag Department.
Madam Chair and Representative Gilliam, you are correct, and we are. This has already been raised with our new congressman, who is on the House Agriculture Committee. Very good for Oregon, and we will continue working on that.
Representative Roblin.
Two-part question. The first one is, you know, we talk about tan oak, and I guess what I want to make clarify to Oregonians, what about the oaks that are in the valley, these big, majestic oaks that we have around here? Are they susceptible? And number two, we talk about host plants. I guess I would like, because I think a lot of people don't understand that some of the prominent host plants are things like rhododendron and azalea and some of our more common plants that we ship all over the world. So, and how long will they stay active in a host plant so that we could move them? Those are the three questions I needed to have.
Madam Chair, Representative Roland, the first question about tan oak is highly susceptible and readily killed. Oregon white oak, it's almost resistant to it. So it you can infect it on purpose, but the chance of it becoming, it's not going to be killed by this pathogen, and the pathogen probably can't spread on it. So Oregon white oak is not in grave danger. California black oak, however, is very susceptible and could support spread of the disease. The host range of this pathogen is extremely wide. Many of the plants in the nursery industry, rhododendrons, azaleas, just the host list probably approaches 100 different plant species. So it can survive on many plants, but it only kills a very few. But nobody wants this pathogen, so all those plants are under quarantine regulations. And the third question?
How long can it stay in a host plant and be transported, be viable?
That question is still being discussed. It can survive in dead tissue on the forest floor in the soil for, we know, at least a couple of years. Not very readily, though. It dies fairly quickly. And that's part of the work that's going on at Oregon State right now, is to determine just how long the pathogen does survive and is able to spread. It can survive, but it may not be able to spread in that respect. So it's fairly persistent. It has a resting type spore that can basically wall itself off against desiccation, and it can live in the soil, live in plants for some period of time.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I really applaud your efforts here. And, Katie, I'm just going to take it your scientific, for face value, that it's attributed to global warming and climate change, even though we know that zebra mussel, scotch broom, Himalayan blackberry, ivy, aquatic grasses, long list of other things, are not attributable to global warming. I know we have to be saying that. Some of us don't work at the pleasure of the governor. But that being said,
to clarify, Representative Schaffler, I didn't attribute this disease to global warming. That we know for sure, but I think if indeed we experience global warming, we are going to see more and more threats
Thank you for that clarification. And this is an issue I think George W. Bush and Barack Obama would be totally in agreement on. Thank the Lord. But, you know, we last week we had some pictures in here where some beetles were eating up some trees on federal land, and we're not doing anything about it. You know, and we're waiting for a cold streak, and God forbid we use any pesticides. If I'm not wrong, correct me, Ms. Koba, that the gypsy moth, we did use pesticides to fight that battle. Is that correct? That's my question.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, yes, we did.
Thank you.
And we are using targeted tools on this disease as well.
Madam Chair, if I may, we need to get on that federal land, cut down those dead trees, or if they burn up, then go and salvage and replant the whole thing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Schaffler. Representative
Krieger. Speaking of chainsaws.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Boy, having this guy to my right's fun. Can you imagine being the right of Krieger? That's pretty bad. Madam Chair, I do, thank the work that has taken place down there. You know, I've been in Curry County since '64. There were 11 mills there when I got there, Now you see a mill and a half, one shut down. So things have really changed down there. And you did mention that it hadn't moved north, and I'm north of it, so keep it where you got it, because my tree farm is just, you know, up by Euchre Creek. So it can really affect small landowners. Yep. It can totally wipe out your ability to have any cash flow, cut anything, move anything. And because of the different host plants, I've had some conversation with Mr. Woosley down there. I've known him for, I don't know, 30 years, something like that. That's kind of heading up part of that eradication down there. But, you know, we've talked about how bad it is for forestry. And we have touched on the fact that, hey, if this thing gets away from us, gets into the nursery stock, what that means. And that is a huge thing. It's not only the nursery business, but it's every yard, every house, every yard in Oregon that stuff can spread to because of the way it affects things. I think one of the things where I want to see the investment continue, because the longer you work with it, the more you learn about it. Now, there's human diseases. We spent 30, 40 years trying to find a cure, and all of a sudden there it was, and they just totally eradicated it. This probably will have the same thing, but we have to keep it controlled, keep the patient alive, so to speak, until we can find a cure. And it's no different. It's going to take an investment, but it's not just the forest products industry that's at stake. There's a lot more to that than that. I want to make sure people understand that.
Well, are we questioned out? We're ready for our private groups?
Just
Representative Wingard. We have one more.
I was going to say, are the forestry people going to speak?
Thank you. Sorry, I'm oblivious. Representative Wingard.
Alan Nasty is with forestry.
I was just spitballing off the top of my head. I thought, you know, we have these quarantine areas.
Yeah.
If we draw 1 or 5 mile boundaries around these areas and log. In an attempt, you know, this is an eradication of disease program. That could produce quite a few jobs, I would think, and especially in some mills.
That implies that there's common sense in the process.
Representative Roblin.
I guess since we went to that session, I was going to ask two other questions. The one has to do with, I know that most of our timber is not a host. However, if you're in a quarantine area, there are restrictions and they have to do things that make the value of the logs less because you have to invest. And I just wanted to get a short explanation of what they have to do to logs that's logged in the quarantine area. And number two, we have, in response to Representative Krieger's question, we have developed a new Port Orford cedar strain that is resistant to the we haven't started really planting a lot of it yet, but we have some. So there are opportunities to get a new tan oak that may be resistant or some other things. Is that not true?
Yeah. Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, yeah, the last question, tan oak, there is some work going on in California that includes Oregon looking for resistance in the native tan oak. As for the regulations, as they affect timber, the biggest problem, of course, is with tan oak because it's the primary host, and so there are very strong restrictions on what you can and can't do with tan oak. And the implication for woodland owners there is many of these stands are mixed forests of tan oak and fir and other conifers, and if you can't utilize the tan oak, then you can't afford to log the other species out of those stands. Sometimes the sale depends on being able to at least do something with the tan oak to make the whole thing profitable because of the logging costs. As for moving the other species out of the quarantine zone, there are some restrictions. You have to do surveys prior to logging to ensure that there is no disease in or near that stand. And those surveys are fairly costly, probably going to be $60 to $70 per acre just for the survey. So it adds a cost to doing business in a business that's already quite marginal in terms of profit. So they have big effects on it. And the larger the quarantine area, then the larger that impact would be. I wonder if I could make one comment to Representative Wingard about the cutting and burning trees and lots of jobs. One of the elements of the sod eradication program is host removal in advance of the disease actually being there. The idea is that if you get rid of the host, the pathogen can't spread. And when you do that and it's not associated strictly with an infested site, then you have some opportunities for utilization that we didn't have otherwise. So we don't have to necessarily cut and burn everything. And there's a number of proposals in the works right now to look at ways to utilize tan oak biomass out along the edge of the quarantine area to get rid of the tan oak before the disease gets there. So there's ways of perhaps cogeneration. There's ways of utilizing the tan oak and making it into fuel briquettes and things like that. So there's some opportunities there to use tan oak and get rid of it at the same time and hopefully slow the spread of the pathogen.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Wingard.
I was just trying to be extra cautious. So I've already named it the Emergency Invasive Species Timber Harvest Program. And I just really feel like there's no time to waste, and we should just draw large circles around these areas and move in as quickly as possible. Why take any chances is really what I'm thinking.
Okay, after reading the minutes of what Representative Gilliam was doing while I was gone about other diseases from California and this, I'm glad I'm back. Let's get some order. So, excuse me, who hasn't gotten to talk? And let's get them to talk so we can get the rest of our folks up. Please.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. Just maybe to kind of tie this up, just touch on just a couple things briefly that we hadn't talked about yet, and that is kind of the status of current funding and eradication effort and what we're looking to just in the very near future. Currently, for the last about 2 months, we did have to scale down our eradication efforts due to just current budgetary issues, the current biennial budget, and us having to plan for potential savings as an agency we may need to provide in terms of general funds. Worst case scenario is if those funds do have to be given up, and it's $265,000 of general funds that we had been awarded by the E-Board last June to continue our efforts, we've had to put a hold on those funds to see what, if any, reductions we will need to take this biennium. Best case scenario, those funds are freed up, and we would continue to use those towards our efforts. Worst case is we would be waiting until sometime in the beginning of March, where we'll start to see some federal dollars from the Forest Service to get the eradication efforts back up to where they were. We anticipate, even if it is just the federal dollars, we anticipate being able to deal with all of the sites that we know as of right now. In terms of how far that money will go for any new sites we come across this season, we don't know. We probably won't be able to continue work through the end of June, but depending on what kind of sites we find this year, we just have to wait and see. So we are still working on eradication. We anticipate to continue doing that close to the end of the biennium, but we'll have to see. There is, Katie made a mention of the federal stimulus dollars. We've looked at two different pieces there. One, our federal stimulus dollars that have already been awarded and are coming our way from the package that was passed last fall. We are looking at those dollars to see if there's the potential, if it's within the scope of those dollars, to use it for sudden oak death. It's not looking promising right now in terms of those dollars. However, the next federal stimulus package that might be coming here that's passed the House but not the Senate yet, our understanding is the sideboards on the use of those dollars, that some of those dollars are going to be going towards forest health treatment and projects, and Oregon's expected to see some of those dollars come our way. Our understanding right now are the sideboards on those dollars might be wide enough, broad enough, that sudden oak death treatment might be included, but we are going to be watching that and pursuing that as best we can. And if those, some of those dollars are available for this treatment, we will be looking to use to do that.
So would it be helpful to have us weigh in with our congressional partners on, I mean, I know there's no earmarks, but criteria that allow for forest health or invasive species treatment?
Chair Clem, I believe so. It couldn't hurt.
But we should actually keep a little list of items to discuss with our federal partners, because I know we ain't going to have a lot of them. And I had a conversation with Representative Schrader. I caught him on the train, so I had him all to myself for a while. And he said, look, I'd like to take my lead on what I'm working on from your legislative committee. I get input from the governor's office and other people, but frankly, I'd like to get a to-do list from your legislative committee once I told him who was on it, particularly Representative Schaffler. So
that's nice to know.
Let's get a to-do list. I'm going to get it to him weekly. Okay. Ready to hear from our folks who out in the private side of the equation.
Keep up the good work.
So I've got Mike Dykesel. Is that how you pronounce that?
Very good, sir.
There's a lot of odd consonants in there. It's a couple Y's. Like
an eye chart?
Yeah. John Aguirre, the more reputable member of the nursery team in the room. Not an it might be an Oregon Duck. I'm not sure. And Mike Dennis. Welcome.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you. I have another motion. I wonder if you could step out for a second.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Morning, Chair Clem. For the committee, my name is Mike Dykesel, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I think the panel that was up before us, can't say enough of. It's a pleasure to work with the two different agencies that are very positive of the fact that we can take care of this. They've been very creative with the limited funds they've had. They've used some innovative and creative techniques to early identify some of the things that Alan Kanaski talked about, the way it spots on the map. One of the things that we've been trying to equate is they detect it, funding issues, timing issues, goes 4, 5, 6 weeks before they can actually get a crew out there to do it. Mm-hmm. What we try to emulate is actually a Department of Forestry initial attack type model where you could have some crews that would be identified, 20-person hand crews, that as soon as the area is identified, you get them out there, you go ahead and take care of it to minimize the spread. But it's been somewhat difficult with the inconsistency on some of the funding, but that's kind of a long-range model. I guess one thing that Representative Clem is kind of focused in is the export and the quarantines of products. You look at that back map on the Department of Forestry's handout that showed all those counties in California's Bay Area. There are 14 contiguous counties under quarantine for sudden oak death. The problem is down there is that all those products that are produced in that quarantine area, there's a huge population. You're actually selling your products within the quarantine area. Oregon and our natural resource partners is unique. We make products that are exported, and that goes for the nursery industry as well as the forest industry. And so I think that can resonate in the complexity and the concern about what do we do if this thing gets out of the box that it's in currently. I think that's a huge one. The other thing that that really is becoming apparent, we all saw what happened in California this last year with wildfires. Unbelievable. Some of those large fires that occurred in the coastal strip of California, it's now coming to light that the dead tan oaks really contributed greatly to the spread and the intensity of those fires. So once again, Oregon and its aggressive system, if this thing ends up getting out of the box, we're going to have a huge impact that we haven't really talked about yet, is the impact of fire risk and fire hazard in some of those forests out there. We talked a little bit about the host species, and we've kind of focused to date so far in this discussion about the nursery industry, and we touched briefly on some of the tree species. Well, Douglas fir is listed as a host species for sudden oak death. It doesn't necessarily transmit well, and I'm sure the experts can give more details, but it has been found in the wild to exist on, not necessarily spread from, but once again, a market-driven concerns over Douglas fir as the state's prime leading tree species for marketability is on the host list. So that's another huge concern for us. The second page of my handout, I give you a copy of what was submitted to the Legislative E-Board back in June. I think the takeaway message here is the logos across the top. What you see sitting next to the Nursery Association, the Nature Conservancy, the Farm Bureau, small woodland owners together, you saw a great partnership with the agencies working together. Well, just to let you know here is that the stakeholder community has really banded together on this as well. We were successful with the e-board approval of $475,000, but as Mr. Paul indicated, I think we're all very disappointed and concerned with the remaining $265,000 being kind of offered up as potential budget savings and the required 5% reduction if necessary. So we're very concerned about that. Just to be real short, we talked a little bit about the Forest Service in here in this committee. We have some opinions. I would agree with most of those opinions, but I think the folks that are working with the Department of Ag and Department of Forestry, the entomologist side of the Forest Service, they have been excellent as far as going to bat, getting funds, trying to be as aggressive as they can. So I know we have a broad picture of them, but I think in this particular point they do recognize the concern and have been working very closely with us to try and support that. I guess my final takeaway message is the back page of my handout. what you can see is this references the quarantine area that you've seen in the previous handouts and gives it a little bit of a broader picture to show who the neighbors are. This is my biggest concern, is this green is all federal lands. If this gets out of the box, and nothing against the agency, but their policies, their concerns, the legal challenges to their aggressive nature to stop this, we have one opportunity to keep this in the box, and that's now. And with that, offer up to my next partner here.
Thank you. Chairman Klim, members of the committee, I'm John Aguirre, Executive Director for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning to talk about sudden oak death in Curry County. Phytophthora ormorum, the pathogen that causes sudden oak death, is a serious issue for our industry. And I just have to comment, I've never seen so much humor milked out of this issue before as I have this morning, so good job. P. ormorum was first found in Oregon nurseries in 2003, and it was a result of that discovery. The Oregon Department of Agriculture, with industry support, launched a comprehensive surveillance and inspection program to look for this pathogen. In 2004, the pathogen was found in 23 nurseries, and I can tell you that was a year of regulatory chaos and marketplace disruption for our industry. The U.S. Department of Agriculture later in that year imposed quarantine regulations on California, Oregon, and Washington, and those quarantine regulations effectively preempted other states from erecting their own independent quarantines, which disrupted shipments, prevented our growers from shipping to multiple states throughout the East and Southeast, and Canada effectively closed off its markets to Oregon nursery growers. It also demonstrates the fact that a pathogen or a new pest like this can overnight turn the marketplace and our industry upside down. Now, since that time, ODA and the Oregon nursery industry have worked very closely together to implement an aggressive, very robust program of inspection regulations, which are proving very successful. In 2008, five nurseries were found to have this pathogen, and the good news is that changes in production practices and the ODA inspection program are working to prevent the spread of this pathogen to other Oregon nurseries, but most importantly, working to prevent the shipment of this pathogen to out-of-state customers. Buyers of Oregon plant material continue to have a high degree of confidence that their purchases are free of P. ormorum. And I can tell you, the Oregon Department of Agriculture has tremendous, tremendous respect by their peers in other states. It's doing an excellent job. Marketplace confidence and perceptions are critical to the continued success of the Oregon nursery industry. In 2007, Oregon growers reported sales of more than $985 million, of which over 80% was shipped to out-of-state buyers. Had buyers of Oregon nursery and greenhouse plants believed that ODA and Oregon growers lacked the will, determination, and the confidence to contain and eradicate P. ormorum, then industry sales would surely have suffered. Our industry remains committed to the task of preventing the spread of P. ormorum. Let me just point out a couple of things. The Oregon nursery industry has embraced a system of licensing and inspection. License fees generate about $1.6, $1.7 million per year for the nursery inspection program. It's that program that allows us to do the good things we do in Oregon to keep plant material clean. The OAN has worked with its peer associations to seek funding for eradication in Curry County. We've retained a lobbyist back in Washington, D.C., and as a result of our efforts and working with the Oregon Congressional Delegation, we've secured funding through USDA APHIS for regulatory programs on P. ormorum. And lastly, I would say the OAN is committed to developing new systems of pest risk management. And we succeeded in putting language in the Farm Bill to support that effort. So the industry is highly, highly committed to preventing the spread of plant pests and diseases.
Mr. Chair?
May I ask?
Mr. Evgelian. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here and for your testimony, Mr. Squire. Just so you know, in this session, if we can't laugh, I think we would be crying. So sorry. Thank you for putting up with this. I want to go back to something you said earlier to make sure I understand it.
I think you were referring to the federal plan that immediately came in for quarantine, and I think you said that was detrimental to the plan that you might have put forward from the private sector, from the association. Can you say more about how you would have handled that to improve the situation?
Well, actually, the federal plan has proved very beneficial. At the outset, we were very concerned about USDA's proposed quarantine because we thought we wouldn't need it. But as the states erected their own independent quarantines, we needed the safety or the shield of USDA regulation to prevent or preempt other states from erecting their own quarantines. So I would say that USDA probably looks to ODA as being the most effective partner in regulating Pyramorum of the three states.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Representative Schaffler?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. We aren't going to know what our general fund budgets are going to be for a few months. And even then, we may have to come back. And I don't know if you guys know the answer, but there's a big, this nice chart of where the money's going. And we referred to the, potential 5, now maybe 10, maybe 20% cuts requested of all departments. I would eventually like to know how much of this is from general fund or if it's from other funds that are dedicated. if you know off the top of your head, if you don't, just someday get it to us because I'd be interested in that conversation.
Do you know, Mike?
Get there, but I'm curious about that, more than curious.
Well, if I may just briefly say that the OAN sees that we are at a crossroads today, and it's the classic dilemma of you can pay me now or you can pay me later. And like our peer associations here, we're very concerned about the proposal to withhold some of these funds. And we understand the very difficult situation that both the Department of Forestry is in, as well as this legislature, to look for budget cutbacks. But I can't emphasize enough that if there is a deterioration or perception among other states that we've lost our will to combat this pathogen, the nursery industry, which is today in dire economic straits, will be hurting for even longer and more severely than otherwise. Thank you.
My name is Mike Dennis, and I'm with the Nature Conservancy. And I want to thank you, Chair and committee members, for this opportunity to testify and join my colleagues and partners here to talk a little bit about sudden oak death. I want to take just a moment, though, to hit two things. First, to talk a little bit about the ecosystem damage that sudden oak death can cause. And secondly, to kind of tie it all together and talk about our coalition and where we're going forward. The Nature Conservancy has over 40 years of dealing with invasive species in Oregon. And sudden oak death is putting challenges before us like we've never seen before. It's a disease that kills, as we've talked about, tan oak and black oak, California black oak, and it infects a whole bunch of other species in Oregon that are critical to our ecosystem, including rhododendron, Oregon myrtle, Pacific madrone. And from this ecosystem perspective, oaks are critical. Critical components of the forest structure, because they're, if you look around, there are over 200 kinds of birds and mammals that feed on parts of oak trees, and acorns are critical food for forest birds, and they also provide habitat for a number of different species. And the effects of uncontrolled sudden oak death on Oregon's ecosystems, as we've talked about, are multiple. Sudden oak death would increase fire risk, fuel loads, reduce slope stability, alter critical habitat, and expose or cause more loss of habitat that we really need, that's necessary to help us recover species such as northern spotted owl and murrelet and salmon. So the threat is real, and Oregonians are really demanding, we feel, action on invasive species as a whole. And sudden oak death is one that we have been working with our partners, the Association of Nurseries, Forest Industries Council, Small Woodlands Association, and the Farm Bureau, with the state agencies to try to partner and lead on these new solutions to help us get a handle and get control over sudden oak death. As Mike had mentioned, we were successful in helping an effort with the state agencies to get emergency board funding of almost $500,000, $427,000. In September, a couple of us from this coalition traveled to Washington, to D.C., to meet with the congressional delegation, and were successful at securing federal funds. And currently, we're working to increase the federal funds that would be directed from APHIS, which is a part of the Department of Agriculture, to sudden oak death. And I want to just make the point that John made, which is we do recognize all the difficult budget decisions that the agencies are making and that you all will be making as well. But we are concerned about the fact that the sudden oak death funding from the emergency board was put on a list of possible cuts. And in addition to the reasons John said, I do want to add that we are working to try to leverage our state resources at the federal level, talking with the delegation, talking with USDA. And one of the key talking points has been how in Oregon we've been stepping up to the plate to fund sudden oak death efforts. And we believe that the reciprocation should be at the federal level. So our concern with this potential cut through the emergency fund is that it may undermine these efforts as we're trying to attract and double this year, the fiscal year 10 appropriation for sudden oak death. So I just want to thank you again for this opportunity. Again, emphasize what a great team we have here, including Katie and Dan and Jim and Alan and all of my colleagues. It's been great to work with them on this. And in a time when it's very easy to get down, I think the thing that keeps us all going is how committed we are to tackle this problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We've got one other person to testify. Any question for this panel?
Mr. Chair, if I may, I don't think we can afford not to fund this challenge here, this fight, this effort. I mean, my district's primarily an urban district, but in the southeast corner of my district, I still have some nursery operations. When you step into Barton's district, they're all over the place. And I hope we're taking a good hard look at maintaining the funding level of this. So I just had to make that comment.
I will, as the only member of the Natural Resources Sub of Ways and Means, carry your concerns forward.
Thank you, sir.
Because there's no doubt you can do the math and say this amount of lost income to the nursery times the state income tax rate is more than the cost of fighting it. I mean, it's a pretty simple equation in this case.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
I really appreciated the comment about this. We need to look at this as fast attack, the kind of issues. Is there an effort between the agencies and private to come up with some kind of a plan to have a funding source like we have with the fire protection plan for invasives in general? And it's much more difficult because there's so much, we don't know what's coming and what it might be and how we get those resources. But I think in this particular disease, had we had the money before, we didn't have to go anywhere, just went there and took out the first trees, we would have at least slowed it and some other things. So I appreciate your idea because I think every time something new shows up in our state, the agencies have to hurry to the emergency board if we're not in session, and there's a pretty good chance we won't be when it happens. And then they've got to make the convincing arguments and do all that stuff before anything can happen. And so I guess, is there any effort moving forward?
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin was talked about a national model here several months ago. The Department of Forestry and Department of Agriculture actually put together a model basically called the final phase. That went through the APHIS scientific community. It has been endorsed as far as looking at a national trial implementation that could become a national model for response to any invasive species. I'm not aware currently of any specific funding source to model it after, but I'm sure that discussion will take place during the session and beyond.
You have two more responses to that.
Chairman Clem, Representative Roblin. The nursery industry a few years back volunteered to tax itself more through this license fee system that we have in place to establish an emergency pest response fund. And that fund now contains about $280,000. And we've been careful to husband those dollars, working with ODA to respond to true emergencies that arise. But I want to point out that we now have Japanese beetle populations around the Portland airport. Previously, we had a wood-boring insect that was brought in on solid wood packing materials at a factory location in the Dalles. And I say those things because we're willing to contribute more dollars. We see the need, but we need to make sure that we capture all those parties that are contributing to the possible introduction of new invasives.
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin. The Oregon, I would add, the Oregon Invasive Species Council has been looking at a concept of establishing an emergency fund for these future outbreaks of other invasives as they happen, so that there doesn't need to be a number of quick returns to the emergency board. But as far as sudden oak death, as Mike was saying, we are looking at some different funding sources through USDA and have spoken with the delegation about those different sources.
Representative Roblin.
Just kind of a comment, because of the one thing that came up here, and it's one I've worried about before, and that is that a lot of invasives are coming in as shipping crate part material and so on, because wherever it's created, that's not the thing they inspect. They inspect what's in the crate, not the crate itself, and we have that issue. But one of the other things that I think we don't understand in Oregon, we produce a lot of timber. We don't produce a lot of lumber from our timber. We import logs from Washington, California, and others to fill our mills. And so we are contributing to the opportunity for things to move into our state from out of state and out of country just to keep our mills going, when we actually do have in the state a lot of product that could be harvested here and have control over and then marketed other places. And I think we sometimes forget that movement of stuff contributes to some of the problems. And for my friends in the environmental community, it also means that we spend more money in transporting stuff to and from, which creates the use of hydrocarbons and other issues. So I just want to make sure that we keep bringing up all the different issues that happen when we don't use the product that is produced right here in our state.
Excellent point.
So thank you.
Point, Representative Krieger.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. A lot of small woodland owners, I know, they own their property, they had to manage their forest, but they also have probably the greatest concern. They also manage for wildlife values. You know, even on my little tree farm, I've got bear, elk, deer, turkeys, and squirrels that utilize those sources. And I specifically and intentionally leave patches of oak 3, 4, 5 acres and don't go in there simply to have that. If this thing moves forward and we have to eradicate all that on private land, you're going to lose a whole lot of habitats being dedicated right now through private ownership, specifically for wildlife.
Representative Van Orden, final comment, then we're going to Greg Miller, then we're going to ODF&W.
Well, the reality is disease, and contagion is contagion. And if you don't either inoculate or eradicate, the contagion will continue and spread. And I think that it's quite obvious that if we don't do something, it will spread.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. In the interest of time, you've spent quite a bit of time on sudden oak death. I'm going to share with you a letter that we submitted to the emergency board. And one thing that hasn't been talked about, I was trying to listen to the testimony, not to be redundant here. I would like to talk a little bit about the economic impacts for one particular landowner. And Weyerhaeuser Company, we have 1.1 million acres here in Oregon. And what I would share with you is that near the current quarantine boundary, we own and manage timberlands.
Mr. Chair, for the record.
Oh, Identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Trying to be quick.
What's the protocol?
For the record, Greg Miller, Weyerhaeuser Public Affairs, Weyerhaeuser Company Public Affairs, and also just by way of background, I'm also a forester, so these aren't this isn't an issue that I'm not familiar with. So to carry on, Coos and Douglas counties, we own timberlands in those two counties. The Millicoma Tree Farm is down that way, and folks that are from that area probably have stumbled along that patch of ground. But what I wanted to draw to your attention in the letter is on the second page, and we looked at the likely spread of sudden oak death that assumes both tan oak as the major species and Oregon myrtle as the minor species, and how that would spread the disease. So we looked at both the ecological assessment and the economic assessment, and we analyzed both a moderate risk and a high risk in terms of the impact to our particular timberlands. And so we also made our assumptions very, very conservative. So the punchline is that on a very moderate risk assessment, we figure it would cost Weyerhaeuser about $1 million annually. On the high end, on the high risk end of this, in terms of the spread of the disease and the economic impacts, we would look at about $6 million per year. So that's the punchline. And the difference is between those two risk assessments is simply the quarantine aspect of this and how it stops the movement of both domestic conifer logs and lumber without any kind of treatment, either kiln drying or fumigation. So I just wanted to get on the record so that you'd have a reality check and a way to check the box here and understand the economic impact for one particular landowner, and would be willing to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Do they require when you're near the deals to wash the trucks like they did with the... Okay, so because it's not transported
right.
The same way.
Correct.
Just so people know, when we had the big infestation with the cedar problem, it created a whole bunch of industry costs, so they didn't transport the stuff. And I think we sometimes forget that each of these things have other costs. And I appreciate you coming and talking about that.
You bet. So just wanted to make sure that was on the record. And I'd be remiss if I didn't once again be one more voice to compliment the Department of Forestry, State Forester Marvin Brown and his team, and the Department of Agriculture and Director Koba, Katie Koba, and her team for working on this, working with the landowners, working with the partners. It's a classic model of what Oregon government's all about and that partnership. So see if you can preserve that, too.
Thank you, Greg. I see no one else on our sign-up sheet, so why don't we transition into our discussion of ODF&W bills and programs. Just, looking at the backside of this, doing the math, in the high-risk scenario just for Weyerhaeuser, if you take the $6 million annually times at their C-Corp income tax rate, double it, because that's annually, biennially, you're $800,000, just one company. And we had a hard time being able to get $427,000 out of the e-board.
It pays for itself.
Yeah. Quickly.
Unbelievable.
Right, Ron and Kurt?
We have to spend that to count that off the business.
That's what we have, right?
Classic example.
Representative Byer, just noisy as usual.
I know, there. I'm just soaking this all in.
The listener learns the most.
A refresher course.
Did you do this before?
I was on ag
couple
for
times,
two
right?
sessions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Same issue?
Hopefully not. In 2003, we had the discussions in 2003 and 2005. Yeah. And
2007.
Yikes.
Every year.
800,000 on 6 million.
Yeah, roughly. Oh. Yeah, 6.6% times 6 million, times 2. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. With me today is Ron Anglin, our Wildlife Division Administrator. Appreciate the invitation to come and provide you with an overview of our seven agency bills that we have coming up during this session, and I believe all seven have been assigned to this committee.
Great. Welcome. Get used to us then, and we'll get used to you.
And we appreciate that. In our testimony here, then, we've laid out all seven bills. They're laid out by bill number. No other importance to the order other than that. And I will go through and provide you with a quick overview. I'm certainly not going to read this testimony verbatim. I'll give you a quick overview on each bill and then happy to answer any questions that you may have. So House Bill 2218 is our Access and Habitat Program reauthorization bill. Our Access and Habitat Program is scheduled to sunset at the end of this calendar year. We are asking for that program to be reauthorized for another 10 years. And the surcharge, which is currently $2, has been $2 since, I believe, 1991. We're asking for that surcharge to be increased to $4. Very briefly, the Access and Habitat Program funds are overseen by a citizen advisory board that determines how to use these dollars to provide both hunter access to private lands as well as improve wildlife habitat on private lands. It's been a very popular program over the last two decades, very successful, and a great partnership with our private landowner partners. One additional aspect of this bill also, you'll see the third bullet there, reduces the number of required applicants for the three private landowner positions from 15 to, and there's a typo in this bill, or in this testimony, to 5. It is correct in the bill, but in this testimony it is listed as 3. That should be 5. We've had trouble over the years getting applicants from the Department of Agriculture and Department of Forestry, getting that number of 15 applicants for the private landowner positions. So it's just simply reducing the number of applicants needed before we can go ahead and appoint those board members.
Kurt, quick question on that.
Do you want questions for each one of these or wait till they're all done?
Your preference, gentlemen?
What's up to you, Chair Clem? However you want to do it.
Well, let's do it as we go, because once we get into more of the fees, I'm sure we'll be stuck for a while.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to, kind of on the record, right now, this whole program of access and habitat program is paid for by fees charged to hunters and fishermen, correct? There is no general fund money from the rest of the state or any money that comes from conservation or other groups that use the habitat or place?
Chair Clem, Representative Roebling, that is correct. This is currently a $2 surcharge is put directly on hunting licenses. There is a what we consider a sister program on the fish side, a $2 surcharge on angling licenses for the restoration and enhancement program. So they're similar programs, one on the fishing side and one on the wildlife side.
So it's the Oregon anglers and the Oregon hunters that are helping us keep habitat available and do things and make access available to other Oregonians.
Chair Clem, Representative Roebling, that's correct.
Chair?
Yes.
Representative Wingard. I'm just wondering if you, when people get a hunting license, do they supply their mailing information, all their contact information to you?
Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, yes, that is correct. We have a full, complete record of their personal information, contact information. All of our licenses are now sold at point of sale, electronic point of sale machines, so there's no longer any data entry. It's really instantaneous.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up? How many hunting and fishing licenses then?
Yeah, off the top of my head, there's a couple hundred thousand, I believe, hunting licenses. I'm looking to Ron Anglin, our Wildlife Division Administrator, here as well. And including daily licenses on the fish side, I believe there's, around 400,000. That includes daily, not just not annual licenses.
Okay, follow-up? Last question, Mr. Chair. Do you any kind of a program where you ask them how they feel about the increase, any increase you're proposing, in this case a $2 to $4 one, where you get some idea that you can provide to the committee about how the people who will pay this fee actually feel about an increase? I might be fishing soon, but in general, I'm not likely to pay this fee.
Hold before the questions erupt. We are going to talk about the public hearing. If you want to answer that directly on, the actual mailing list, and then we're going to hear a longer discussion, I think, of the public hearing process you went through around the state on this and other fees too. But if you want to do that, and then if there are different questions on different topics, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Yep. Thank you, Chair Clem, Representative Wingard. We currently do not do any direct mail surveying of our license holders with regard to proposed fee increases. We did do an extensive public process as part of our budget proposal, which includes not only this package, but also our general license fee proposal. So as we get into that that bill discussion, I'll go into a little more detail on our public outreach.
And we will hear from some of the organizations that represent some of those license holders. Obviously, not everyone belongs to the Oregon Hunters Association just because they buy a tag, but they'll have some comments, and then we'll have Oregon Hunter Day, too, where lots of people, members or not, will come in and feel free to ask them, too, what they think of it on that day.
Just one last question, Mr. Chair. I'm sure that whatever public process you do has some cost involved in your staff time and all that, and I just wonder if it isn't less expensive to do sampling. You know, you have 400,000 licenses. If you did some kind of a mailed survey to a few thousand people, whatever would be a statistically relevant sample, figuring that some won't return it, it seems to me you get a much more accurate read on the cross-section of users rather than a public meetings process, which I just, from my experience, doesn't tend to bring in the cross-section.
Sure. Good input. Gentlemen? Did one of you, you want to chime in on this one? Representative Krieger, then Schaaf. Vice Chair, excuse me.
Mr. Melcher, the surcharge on the angling license, the use of those dollars for restoration enhancement, you and I were talking a few minutes ago, is that statutory or is it administrative rule how they can use those dollars?
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, I believe that's specific in statute, and we'll follow up on that with you and the committee to give you that answer definitively.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the reason we were speaking about this earlier is when the public or the user group see that they're going to have a direct benefit from an increase of some type, they're more than likely possibly be more inclined to go along with it. And I was specifically referencing the fact that we have not done the work that we should on research for salmon and the hatcheries and that type of stuff, and this would be a place, I think, where the department could use some more dollars and work with Dr. Noakes at the research hatchery and get specific questions answered. There are some things we need to know that they're not looking for now because there's no money there to do it.
Representative Schaaf.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You came in 6 years ago for an increase, and I think it was this hearing right here where you said you were going to be back in 6 years, and now you're back. And back then, and I believe now, as my friend to my left here said, the people that use this resource and fund this resource are all for protecting and maintaining and enhancing this resource as long as they have access to it. But I don't believe if you did that mail survey, you'd find that they're very interested in locking up huge parts of the ocean or creating an area of critical concern enveloping the entire state of Oregon. I just want to know that I'm not interested in funding any, voting for any fee increases that lock up the oceans. I'm not interested in that. If we want to have two marine reserves, great, and fund the science and the research that goes into that, great. I'm not opposed to that idea. But I am not interested in any of this money going to those concepts. I just want to share that with you. And I believe the majority of the men and women and children that have these licenses agree with me. So thank you very much, and keep up the good work.
let's try and get through another bill.
Okay, thank you. Just a quick follow-up then, Chair Clem, Representative Schaaffler, and our Marine Reserves piece of the budget is entirely on the general fund side. No fee or fee increase is being directed towards that effort. And that is one of the things we heard loudly in our public process that we held around the state with 13 town hall meetings was folks did not want license dollars being used for marine reserves.
Thank you very much.
So with that, then I'll move on to the second bill, number 20, House Bill 2219, is an extension of the Landowner Preference Program. We have a Landowner Preference Program that essentially provides hunting tags, deer and elk tags, to landowners. Particularly in areas where we have controlled or quota numbers set on the number of tags allowed for that wildlife management unit. The program was initiated in the early 1980s to provide, when we went to these quota-based hunting scenarios, to provide opportunities for landowners to hunt on their own property.
The current program sunsets, again, at the end of this calendar year. We're asking for the program to be reauthorized for a 15-year period through 2026. The bill also expands the definition of family, or excuse me, of immediate family, to be consistent with the inclusion of domestic partners, as most state definitions now have. There are some modifications proposed to the landowner preference tag, which would benefit landowners. It would provide buck antelope tags for landowners with 5,000 or more acres. It would increase the number of landowner preference tags for antler, deer, and elk that could be transferred to non-family members. So many of these landowners will sell or lease access to their property and then provide a tag, one of their landowner tags, to the individual that pays for access. It also would allow the landowner to donate these tags to any 501c3 nonprofit charitable organization that could then be used as a fundraiser through auctions, raffles, or other means. And it would additionally authorize a 6-year pilot program to provide additional landowner preference tags to landowners that allow public access for disabled hunters, youth hunting opportunity, or that allow access through their property to public lands.
Representative Wingard, Representative Roblin, and the chair would like to comment.
Sorry for the questions, but a lot of this is new to me, so I'd like to understand. My question is it sounds to me like the program, the tags, are they can only give them to immediate family in whatever way that you define that. And I guess my question would be, if that's true, why? Why are they limited in who and what they can do with the tags that they receive in exchange for the fact that their land is open for hunting?
Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, there's not a presupposition that their land is open to the public for hunting. Right now, as it stands, this program allows the landowner to transfer one-third of their tags to non-family members, so friends or business acquaintances, whatever the case may be. What we've proposed here is to liberalize that and allow them to transfer up to half of their tags to non-family members. So it's not in exchange for access to our public hunting access. It's in basically an exchange for one to allow them the opportunity to hunt on their own property, which most people covet, and secondly, to also recognize the important relationship that we have with landowners in that they do provide great wildlife habitat and habitat benefits and improvements for our resources.
Thank you.
Yep.
Senator Roblin.
When we make decisions to limit the number of tags we're going to have for any particular species that we're hunting, do we subtract all of this potential out before we make the decision as to how many we're going to allow to be sold?
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, I will defer that question to Mr. Anglin here, our Wildlife Division Administrator. I think I know the answer, but I'm going to let him because I know he knows the answer.
Very good question.
Thank you, Chair Clem, and Representative Roblin. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Yes, we do typically subtract out. There's only a certain number of animals that are available for hunting purposes. We look at, you know, how many typically are taken by landowners under landowner preference tags, and then subtract that off the top and then calculate the rest of the controlled hunt tags for the public based on that.
So. So you don't take the total number that would possibly be taken, but you take a statistical number of how many generally get used. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So this increases a little bit the number. So you will probably increase the number, even though we don't have a history of that.
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, I'm not 100% sure I understand your question.
Well, as I read this, doesn't it increase actually the number of tags available in particular cases for landowner use? And we haven't done that before, therefore you'll have to take an estimate of how many of those you think will be used before we subtract.
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, that's correct. We actually have calculated out already as part of our committee that came up with these recommendations how many potential tags there could be, and how many landowners might take advantage of that.
Thanks. Representative Krieger, did you have something?
Yeah, just you mentioned one-third of the tax would be transferred to a non-family member now.
Chair Clem, Representative.
Landowner preference.
Krieger, it's roughly a one-third formula. It's not exactly that. Right now, it depends. There's, based on your amount of acreage and how many tags you qualify for.
So I'm allowed two.
Right.
I can get one.
That's correct.
And one-third of two isn't one. So
unless
you're in the Ways and Means Committee.
That's why I say
the Revenue Committee better.
That's how they go.
And Representative Krieger, it's roughly one-third, but it depends on the amount of acreage. The proposal that came out of the committee was to simplify it and just make it 50%.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up, because there is a lot of concern, and there's a lot of competition by different user groups. And one of the things I wanted to bring out, I've talked to Al Elkins about it, I've talked to your agency. As a landowner, I can get that landowner preference tag every year if I want. But if I go into the regular drawing in some of these areas, like the South Coast, you're going to be somewhere between the fourth and fifth year average before you draw that tag as a resident of the state of Oregon. But a Californian can come in and hunt archery in my backyard and get a tag every year, and you've got to stop that. I've talked to you about it. It's wrong. And I'm not going to vote for your fee increase until you fix it.
Help me understand, Mr. Chair.
Just one moment. The Chair's going to comment. This bill is not moving until my concerns are satisfied as well. I've talked to the interested parties in both the farming community and the hunters that I'm not good with it at the moment. They're talking. Representative Krieger's input might very well be needed in that process, too. This is not a resolved issue.
Yeah.
This bill doesn't pass. The whole program grows away, so I intend to see it worked out. But you know, you're going to see a different proposal by the time this comes to you. Representative,
I just want to understand what Representative Krieger means by a California getting preference, because the owner could give that tag to a Californian, or they can participate in the program.
Well, no,
as well.
It has to do with the different user groups, Mr. Chair.
Please.
If you got a resident who wants to hunt with a bow, or a non-resident that wants to hunt with a bow, he can just go down and buy a tag.
Right.
But if you have a resident
who is not
a landowner,
you just buy it. There's no draw.
He has to draw, so he's going to get a tag every fourth to fifth year, and the resident, non-resident, will get one every year.
Both wanting to hunt with a bow?
No. No.
On the west side, generally speaking, most hunts don't require a controlled hunt because there's either enough animals or not enough ability to kill an animal, in my case, that results in a sustainable population, so they don't draw. So anybody could get one. You buy one. Any out-of-state resident could come and buy one as well. Then there's the controlled hunts, where every time one's taken out of the pool, by an out-of-state person, by a landowner who uses it for themselves, by a landowner who sells it to somebody from in-state or out-of-state, the average Oregon resident is now moved out a couple of years before they're going to actually build up enough preference points to win their draw.
And you say controlled hunt. Are we talking about a type of species or certain places in the state where it...
Both. It's a unit. There's units that you would say, I want to draw. I want to put in for the lottery, basically, on the Beulah unit, which is a place, but then it's also mule deer. Yeah. Antelope, same sort of deal. Antelope in different units, male and female.
Well, just let me add my voice to this as somebody who's about 5 minutes into this issue, and some of you are years into it. I would also be concerned about anybody out of state being able to access the hunting of this wildlife ahead of residents of Oregon. So
before I let you talk about the federal court cases on this and all the other stuff, we do have a ratio that I've, right when I got here, I immediately went after these guys on this. I'm not done with it either.
Sure.
Let's, Representative Byatt.
Having had some experience in these discussions, I guess I want to catch myself up. When was the last time any changes were made to this program? And also, did these recommendations come out of your public process?
Chair Clem, Representative Beyer, the last time this program was reauthorized was 10 years ago. so it had a 10-year, it's at its 10-year sunset. We did have a work group comprised of members of numerous hunting organizations as well as private landowner representatives, Farm Bureau and others, Cattlemen's Association, that worked on the reauthorization of this bill as well as recommendations for changes to the program. Not all of their recommendations were adopted and by the Fish and Wildlife Commission, so not all their recommendations are included in this proposed House Bill 2219.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up.
Please.
I seem to remember, whether it was 03 or 05, that we did have significant discussions on this. And if I remember right, there were some changes made at that point.
Yes. Chair Clam, Representative Beyer, in earlier here, about 5 years ago, we did do a pilot program in Southwest Oregon, which was to provide tags to smaller land acreage landowners. And so that's what you're recalling is our pilot program, which is still in statute, and that's what you're recalling.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I've calmed down slightly. Thank you.
I should hope so, Mr. Chair.
This one really does light me up.
Bothering.
Yeah. There is an issue with the federal government and their view of sort of the legality of programs that restrict out-of-state folks from participating in what I consider our wildlife in Oregon. So we have a program that talks about, I think it's 5% of the overall tags can go to out-of-state folks. The other 95% can't. Now, other states, I mean, that's kind of pushing the envelope to what the federal government, I think, considers legal anyway. We've been fortunate to have that ratio. I would like to continue conversations about whether we could shift to a 5%, well, whether, A, the question, is it a 5% per draw per unit, or is it 5% overall number, and therefore it might be 75% of a given unit or out-of-staters, because everybody else is trying, futilely to get a tag or kill it a deer in Western Oregon because it's difficult. That's my question.
Chair Clem, with regard to the non-resident cap, if you will, it is 5% of the controlled hunt tags per unit per species. So it's not, it would never exceed 5% in a given unit for the controlled hunts.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Krieger is referring also to the general season. So those caps are for our controlled hunts where we limit the number of tags, in other words, limiting the number of hunters in that area for the season. For the units where we have general seasons, where there is no cap on the number of tags, those units and those seasons have no non-resident limit. So it's unlimited for residents. It's unlimited for non-residents. The controlled hunt units and species are capped at 5% non-residents.
Okay. Let's move on.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll be back.
Chair Clem, members of the committee. Then the next bill is House Bill 2220, which is a bill again related to invasive species. In this case, aquatic invasive species.
We were going to hear this today, as you may have noted, but you explained our situation.
Thank you, Chair Clem. It relates to our ability to set up and mandate that folks stop at check stations, folks who are towing or otherwise transporting recreational or commercial vessels. We had a little issue with the language and the constitutionality of the way the original bill was written. So rather than come before you here with that today, we're working with legislative counsel to hopefully resolve those issues. It has to do with our ability to mandate that folks stop at the same time creating criminal penalties associated with the transport of those invasive species. So,
Representative Robles got a question on this one.
I just want to note that last session I caused a furor with my little Marine Board kind of one that would allow us not only to stop them but to force them to clean their vehicle, their boat. And I will reintroduce that. It's going to be available because this has to be taken care of this session. So we have to have this done, and we'll figure it out.
Just for your information, it wouldn't be the first time when Elsie told me something was unconstitutional. I said, draft it anyway, please. It seemed to work in a more appropriate fashion than I do, but I understand the delay.
Thank you, Chair Clem. And Representative Roblin, we have been working with the Marine Board on this bill as well as we drafted it. They're not a sponsor, but we've been working with them. We do obviously think that this is a very important issue. Fortunately, as it relates to transporting aquatic invasive species, unlike what you heard about earlier with the sudden oak death syndrome, we have relatively few pinch points where we know vessels would be transiting into the area, in particular from California or Nevada, where they now have, much like the sudden oak death syndrome, they now have quagga and zebra, or quagga or zebra mussels in, I think, about 15 reservoirs now in California, as well as Lake Mead and perhaps, I don't remember them all off the top of my head, but... So we'll continue to work on that, and we will have something back before you here this session. House Bill 2221, a similar invasive species-related bill with regard to the control of feral swine. We have feral pigs. We have, in the state of Oregon, currently very few feral swine populations. We've had a few incidences where we've worked and taken measures to eradicate those animals. Again, California has a very large and robust feral swine population, which is a serious issue for not only ecologically for their wetlands and river-type habitats, but also for agricultural interests. This bill would essentially make it unlawful to sell hunts for feral swine, which we think will take away the incentive for individuals to want to release and establish populations. It also imposes a civil penalty for introduction or selling those hunts, as well as addresses or expects landowners and land managers to address those populations when they know they occur.
Representative Roblin.
Have we continued to take care of our feral buffalo program plan? We have any buffalo problems still over there?
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, I'm not sure about that, and I could ask Ron Anglin here if he knows anything, and if not, we'll follow up.
Okay.
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, they're primarily classified as livestock under Department of Ag, and there's a few incidences where they do get away, and we work with Ag and the landowners to resolve that.
At some point, if anyone's interested, I do have an interesting story about one time driving in Eastern Oregon with Senator Wyden when a buffalo got up from laying from the driveway where it was just sunning itself, came running after the car until the owner came out, yelled at it to get back, and it went back and laid back down, and I am not kidding.
Down buffy.
I am not kidding.
We actually had testimony from a person, a lady from Portland, who that same buffalo, probably, because I don't know many buffaloes that do that. Ran down the driveway after their car, so.
Yeah, it was. Welcome, it was Senator Wyden's first visit to that county.
Mr. Chair, I can vouch that is a Republican buffalo, and it is red.
It was my bumper sticker.
But I did want to suggest that if we're going to move this bill, I can see it being called the wild pig bill, and I would just suggest it not be one of the early bills we move.
Thank you.
And draw unwanted and unnecessary attention.
Good point. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Have we identified areas where these pigs are located, or are they just intermittent in the state?
Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman, we have had a couple of incidences where they have been released and also established. I know we've worked with the USDA APHIS folks in terms of controlling those populations. We've also had individuals, members of the hunting community or landowners that have actually gone out on their own, and right now they have free rein. If there's feral pigs, they can take care of them without any regulation or regulatory restrictions. So they've been relatively small. We hope to keep it that way.
Okay, so they're not follow-up. Yep. So they're not in particular any geographic area. It's just sort of scattered around the state.
Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman, when we actually testify on the bill, we'll provide you with a map of the known locations at this point in time in the areas of concern.
The purple and not the yellow.
And, yeah, the purple.
That's
purple are the pig locations at this point. So we'll go into more detail on that when we actually testify on the bill.
Thank you.
Good. Just for the record, you picked Marshfield Pirate colors there on your map. Good work.
And they put Curry County purple again. I don't understand.
Couple of alumni.
There was some overlap between the invasive species and those pig areas. And the pirates, maybe. We keep spreading everywhere, don't we?
Are you sure that's not you, Dub?
Oh, I'm certain. we're out of state. Yes, gentlemen. Next bill? Or
thank you. Next bill.
I got a question.
Oh, Representative Krieger.
Yeah.
Clear the room.
Serious question, probably, actually.
Well, you're going to have to prove compensation to prove that someone sold a hunt. In other words, I could have someone come on my property, kill a pig, and it would be up to the game officer to prove compensation, which, if they're at all coached, would be very, very difficult. But we do want to reduce them. I just want to make sure we don't make it impossible for the landowners to get rid of them if they want to. The other thing is, this kind of reminds me of the confined pig bill we had last session. Remember that? Jenny Verdicts?
Yeah.
And we voted on that in committee. Everybody said, oink.
Sure. We'll try and not wear our snouts to the point, at least.
Fair enough. House Bill 2222, then, is our Restoration and Enhancement Program reauthorization. We talked a little bit about this when we were also discussing the Access and Habitat Program. This is the program on the fish side, which will sunset at the end of this calendar year, December 31st, 2009. Currently is a $2 surcharge on fishing licenses. We're asking for the program to be extended for another 10 years and the surcharge to be increased from $2 to $4. As part of this bill, we also have an increase in the fish screening surcharge from 25 cents to 75 cents and a fish passage surcharge of 25 cents. We talked a little bit about the Restoration Enhancement Program. Like the Access and Habitat Program, we have a Restoration Enhancement Board that makes recommendations to the commission on projects to fund. These are projects that restore and enhance both recreational and commercial fishery opportunities. Commercial fish fishermen on the salmon side, both Columbia River gillnet fishermen as well as ocean salmon troll fisheries, do contribute to the Restoration Enhancement Program as well. The current $2 surcharge has been in place since 1991. A few words about the fish screening surcharge. We have a program, a long-standing program, where right now there's a 25-cent surcharge put on fishing licenses. It helps fund our fish screening program, which works with private landowners, municipalities, and generally with water diversion interests to make sure that, first of all, that diversions are screened as required by statute. It's a cost-share program where we cost-share with the private interest to screen their diversion, and then also to help maintain those screens. The 25-cent surcharge has been in place for a long time. We're asking for it to be increased to 75 cents. We're also expecting, at least with all the uncertainty in the federal budget, this program is also lottery funded. We're expecting significant lottery fund cuts to our screening program, as well as perhaps on the federal side, some federal cuts to that screening program. So we're looking to increase the surcharge to stabilize that and continue to provide the services that it provides. And for the first time, we've had a fish screening task force and a fish passage task force that works on fish passage obstructions. That task force has never been funded, and so we do have a 25-cent surcharge to allow that task force to put fish passage programs and projects on the ground, work with interest, private interests on that.
Before we move on, we're running out of time, so I'm just going to make a comment, but I would like to visit with someone, probably at my office, but sometime before this hits Ways and Means, I want to talk about fish screens and sort of the expensive maintenance versus installation and the use of some of the new technologies that I've been reading about in the front page of the Oregonian for certain sloped climates where you can have horizontal fish screens that don't have moving parts and some of those issues.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Clem. We'll happy to do that. We talked also briefly a little bit about House Bill 2223. That's our agency fee bill. This House Bill 2223 increases the fees on recreational fishing and hunting licenses for both residents and non-residents. It includes a reduced fee package for resident and non-resident juvenile anglers and hunters, and it increases the fees on commercial and occupational licenses. In brief, we went through, over the last year, we began developing our budget almost a year ago, in fact, 1 year ago, with the formation of our external budget advisory committee, which is comprised of about 45 citizens and group representatives that helped us craft our budget. We then took that budget out to 13 town hall meetings around the state and gathered input from the public. And then finally, in the budget development process, took our budget and our fee package to our commission for additional comment and public comment and authorization or adoption by the commission. As Representative Schaffler mentioned, we were before you all in 2003 seeking a fee increase. At that time, we expected and projected that our request would last us through three biennia or 6 years. We've accomplished that, and we're at this stage in the cycle where we come back and need to seek an additional fee increase to stabilize the agency programs and the services we provide. Of this fee package that's laid out here, about 81% is directed at maintaining current program, with 19% directed at enhancements, things that our constituents told us they wanted out of any fee package. One of those enhancements is, as I mentioned, some reduced fees on youth participation, particularly on the hunting side, to try and turn around the trend and increase participation levels. Other enhancements that are included in this package are refunding the Sandy Hatchery. Sandy Hatchery is currently mostly federally funded and also funded with PGE mitigation dollars, which are mitigation for Marmot Dam, and with the dam removal, that mitigation obligation is going away, so we're looking to shore up the funding for Sandy Hatchery. It includes increased trout production, which is one of the things our constituents told us they were very interested in, more trout, more catchable trout. It includes additional fish and wildlife troopers, particularly in Central Oregon, where there's been a great interest from the hunting community on having additional enforcement. It includes additional big game census work and additional green forage work on private land and working with our private landowners that provide a great resource to Oregon's fish and wildlife, and many times at their expense. So we have a green forage program that helps offset those costs. It also includes additional commercial fish enforcement for work related to commercial fisheries, alternative gear research for looking at alternative fishing gears, and lastly, some new Willamette River monitoring work. I mentioned that we went through the external budget advisory committee process as well as 13 public meetings. We had a total of over 300 members of the public attend those meetings. And, of course, we are also taking comment at our commission meetings and through written or email comments. We're currently projecting that this package then would get us through another three biennia or 6 years. With that, we have one last bill, but
I'll let them read about it because they got a pile of questions.
Yep.
I think it's pretty straightforward on the last bill. It's just employee background checks.
Yes.
Some agencies already can do, and they'd like to be able to do it if they're dealing with certain things. So Representative Roblin, then Wingard, then Gilliam, then Schaffler.
Mine is more of a comment. I appreciate the fact that you came to North Bend, had one of these public hearings, and we had a lot of people there to talk about fee increases, and I got some emails back because I didn't get to stay for the whole meeting, but a number of people have contacted me and were pleased that you sent out information back about what took place at the meeting. There were a lot of people who didn't agree with what you wrote back, and I just want to mention that. They felt there was a lot more controversy with respect to the fee increases. There were a lot more people that were opposed to it than it appeared to come out in the report that you sent back. And more than a few, including those that approved the fee increase, said the same thing. So I just wanted to make sure that you got that information from me, that at that particular meeting, the kind of follow-up write-up did not appear to be the same as what happened at the meeting from some people's perspective. I wasn't there for the whole meeting. I can only relay that to you from some of my constituents.
You're right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if I'm missing something because you don't say on here what the fee increases would actually be, percentages, but I'm looking for dollar amounts. Do you have any kind of a schedule or
they do, and it'll be in the bill as well when we hear it.
But Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, we do have a complete schedule of proposed fees. I'll just give you a couple general numbers to work from. So a resident angler's license, which currently costs $24.75, this is for an annual fishing license, currently $24.75. With the fee increase as well as the surcharges that we've described here earlier, the total would go to $32.50, so $32.50. Resident annual hunting license with, again, all the surcharges, currently is $22.50, would go to $29. We do have on the non-resident side of the ledger, and this I'm just giving you a couple of brief summary points, but on the non-resident side of the ledger, substantially larger fee increases proposed. So, for instance, the current non-resident angler is $61.50. We have a proposed fee of $105.75. That's for an annual non-resident. Let's see, non-resident... For instance, a non-resident deer tag currently in Oregon is $264. We're proposing that go to $375.
Mr. Chair, we're going to be shared all this information, aren't
we? We are.
Yes,
is that,
you
that
are.
Enough for a
flavor?
Yeah, I was trying to get
okay.
it. Thank you.
Great. Yep. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What time are we on the floor?
About 10:10 or 10:15.
Okay. This is just a quick question, and then I want to follow up. I want to make something on record. In this 2223, which I understand we're not hearing right now,
right,
but
yeah.
is the under the bullet point commercial licenses, is that where potential fee increases to the my elk ranches would be covered?
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, the currently the fees for the Cervid Ranchers and Cervid Ranching it's part of our budget bill. It's not part of this fee bill directly. Hmm. So
we don't, pardon me, Ms.
Yeah,
Paul,
please follow.
We won't hear that here. That because it's in the budget bill.
Yeah, that's new to me actually. So this is that is it how did you not need fee authority in a bill that way? Is it just ratified as part of your budget bill, or does your commission set that? And then how does that work? On
Chair Clem, some of the fees are set by rule by the commission and not through statute.
Yeah.
So what we have to do is go through the commission process and then come in front of Ways and Means
okay.
with as part of the full budget. And the
Cervid Ranches are one of those.
The Cervid Ranches.
So does that answer your question?
It does, but I want to go on record, if I can, Mr. Chair, just real quickly. A change of subject, not directed at these gentlemen, but it's just my view that it would be ill-advisable for any committee, certainly this one. I'm on four. I don't know how many you serve on. For us to start doing fee bills of any type, and they're justified, they're interesting. I've learned a lot about it today. But for us to send a fee bill down before we've made, as a body, some pretty serious fiscal decisions that everybody in this building is aware of, I think is unwise. So I just want to go on record as saying that. Okay. That bringing these in willy-nilly, if I was in their shoes or in other committees, water resources, I'd try to get my fee bill in early, too, in this climate. But I've got rural folks with well problems, and we're going to jack them up. I've got hunters and fishermen may or may not agree with these fee bills, and I think we've got some pretty important fiscal decisions to make before we start doing fee bills. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now you're preaching to the choir. That's why you have this one. Then we'll have a hearing on them. No moving. We'll have Hunter Day. We'll discuss that. We'll have Fisher Day. Then we'll talk about whether we have a vote on these bills.
Thank you.
With that, thank you very much, gentlemen. Good start. I'm going to adjourn our committee.
Thanks.